So we're in verse 20, where we're going to look and see that some Greeks visit Jesus, and we're going to see that Jesus acknowledges this as the beginning of the end. And so that's where we are. And then in the rest of the section, he's going to explain why some people believe and some people don't. Let me correct that. Why most people don't believe, while some do, the few. So we're in John chapter 12 and verse 20. Now there were some certain Greeks among those who were going up to worship at the feast. Now let's identify them from just that context. Greeks, are they Jews? No. Why are they going up to the feast? Obviously they're a proselyte. Now for those who don't know what a proselyte, someone help them. What is a proselyte? Someone that's converted to Judaism, but wasn't born a Jew. So they felt like, you know, here in this case, they're Greeks. And they say, well, we want to become Jews. And they're dedicated enough. They're actually coming to Jerusalem for the Passover feast. That's, you know, quite a commitment. So they're coming and they come up to the feast and they came to Philip, who was from Bethsaida of Galilee. And they began asking him, saying, sir, we wish to see Jesus. Now, what's interesting about this, well, you tell me, what are the implications? Like, how do they know about him then? So people are talking, and what are they talking about? The miracles. You can't keep bona fide miracles, you know, hidden. The news about him has been spreading over and over. And of course, they're also interested in his teaching, because no one has spoke to us like this man. But these men, and we don't know where they're from, but we would assume they're from some distance, they want an audience with Jesus. Now that's incredible, because being Jews, they understand from the Old Testament that the prophets, you know, God spoke through them and promised that a coming Messiah or a Christ would come. Now they didn't know who he would be by name. And so no doubt, though, when they hear about the miracles of Jesus and his teachings, they're in their mind, they must think, this must be the Christ. Now, that's amazing. Have they seen a miracle? No, it's just because of the eyewitnesses or the testimony given to them by others. Are we in the same case? We don't see the miracles, but they've still been left with us to give us a beyond a reasonable doubt that Jesus is the Christ. So Philip called Andrew, and Andrew and Philip came and told Jesus. I like how all the connections are. Philip told Andrew, they both came to Jesus. So Jesus' response is really, I had that up there. His response is interesting in verse 23. And Jesus answered them saying, the hour has come for the Son of Man to be glorified. Now, truly I say to you, unless a grain of wheat falls in the earth and dies, it remains by itself alone. But if it dies, it bears much fruit. Now, the first response we have to kind of dissect. The hour has come for the Son of Man to be glorified. If we had enough time, we'd look at every verse. Well, I have some of them up here, okay? In chapter 2 and verse 4, he's already spoke and said to the woman, that was when they converted the water to wine, my hour is not yet come. What is he referring to when he says, my hour is not come? Okay, it's death, burial, and resurrection. And so the time, there's in chapter 6, they try to make him a king physically by force, and he drives them away and goes up in the mountain himself because his hour has not come. So it's a combination of his death, burial, and resurrection, but to the point, the climax of his ministry, where the people recognize this is the Christ, we want him to be our king. Is that happening when he enters Jerusalem now? What have they done? They lay down palm branches and hail the Son of David. They are calling him out to be the Christ. And so now he says, the hour's come, but up until this time, he's consistently said, my time is not yet here. And that's in chapter 7. In chapter 7, verse 8, when he's talking about going to Jerusalem, he said, they were seeking to kill him, so he said, my time is not yet here. So go up to the feast yourselves. I don't go up to feast because my time is not yet fully come. Again, we're interested in this because is Jesus operating on a very specific timetable? Yes. You know, it's a 3-year ministry, but it's all orchestrated from God. So they tried to seize him in chapter 7, verse 30. The Jews did. But no one laid on hand on him because his hour had not yet come. Now, in Luke, we find the very same thing, that they tried to grasp him, but he would slip from their midst. Now, I've always wondered, the text doesn't say, was it miraculous or just providential, or he was just sneaky? We don't know, but here we have an indication why they weren't allowed to grasp him at that time. And again, the answer was, it wasn't his time. His hour had not yet come. That's interesting. Do a lot of people in the Old Testament have an hour of their life? The moment of their life? Think about Esther. Did she, her hour come? Yeah, when she could save all of her people, she had to choose to potentially sacrifice her own in doing so. Samson, that's right. Push the building, all right. Abram, did he have his hour? You know, several of them. How about Noah? God called him, and he built an ark. And so, will we have that moment in our life? And I don't know when it is, when God's calling you to do something or to stand up for him. And we might be coasting, and all of a sudden your hour has come. And we have to be ready. He goes on to say in chapter 7, verse 44, some of them wanted to seize him, but no one laid a hand on him. Again, why would you think that's the case? They come back and said, well, where is he? And he said, we've never heard a guy talk like this. He said, you aren't going to be converted too. So chapter 8 and verse 20, no one sees him because his hour had not yet come. Now in chapter 13, the next chapter, we're going to see before the Feast of the Passover, Jesus knowing that his hour had come, and he would what? Depart from this world to the Father. So you're correct when you say the hour refers to his death, burial, and resurrection, the climax of his ministry, the purpose for which he came. And now that's what he's going to talk about to his disciples as he announces his death. Now here's my question. Why did these Greeks prompt this statement? Greeks are looking to seek Jesus face-to-face audience, and he goes, oh, my hour's come. And up until this time, not here, not here, not here, it's here. Why did that prompt his statement? Dun, 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 dun. Lorraine? Okay. Exactly. Jesus came to seek and save the lost, and he's been telling them, I have sheep that are not of this of this fold. They have other sheep. And he's always been hinting it's a worldwide salvation. And now it's getting to the point that you can't contain it anymore, just within the boundaries of Israel. It's spreading worldwide. And he goes, that's it. It's over. It's happening now. And it's like this critical mass. Anyone read the book Tipping Point? You know that book, right? You get to a critical mass, and things just tip, and you cannot stop them then. And that's what's happening here. And of course, that's what happened when they start spreading the gospel as well. So I think it's very powerful. In chapter 17, and verse 1, his last prayer before he dies that's recorded for us, he says, the hour has come. He's talking to God. Glorify me with the glory I once had with you. He's asking to go home. It's a beautiful picture there. So there it is. And that's why he says, this little parable or story about a grain of wheat, unless it falls to the ground. Now, we understand that, don't we? So here's some wheat, and for you to get a wheat plant, what does that seed have to do? It has to get in the ground and die. Does it materially change or decompose or deconstruct or whatever you want to call it? In other words, when this plant comes up, can you find the seed anymore? No, it's just a miracle of life, how that seed changes into a plant or a tree or whatever it is. But this principle is what Jesus is drawing on, that we all are keenly aware of. We understand it intuitively, that a seed falls, it's buried, and then new life springs up. Now, he's now saying the same thing, and he's speaking about his death, burial, and resurrection. That who is the seed? It would be him, his own body. He has to die and be buried, but will he stay dead? Now, they don't understand this, but he's giving them a picture, a hint of what's to come. He's going to come back to life, never to die again. A new life, all right? And it's going to be the picture of the gospel, because isn't this the gospel right there, the death, burial, and resurrection of Christ? And do we all imitate the gospel in our own lives when we come to Christ? In baptism, we come to Christ and we die with him. That seed is planted. We're buried with him. And then what? We're raised, Romans chapter 6 and verse 3 and 4, to walk in newness of life, never to die again. Yes.
That's what I had.
Oh.
Exactly. Baptism to us, and also us physically. We're going to die someday, and if we're a Christian, we're going to be raised in new life as well.
And more importantly, the last part of what you just said, when we look at 1 Corinthians 15, whole chapter on the resurrection of Christ, and the whole argument, Paul says, what? Some of you guys are teaching there's no resurrection of the dead? If there's no resurrection of the dead, then who wasn't raised? Jesus. And if Jesus wasn't raised, your faith is worthless. What are you guys doing here? He said, everything is based on the resurrection because it proves the deity of Jesus Christ, but it also gives us hope. And that's what he talks about in chapter 15 down in verse 20 through 24. Now that Christ has been raised from the dead, he's the first fruits. Now the phrase first fruits means what? Someone tell me. First fruits. It goes back to the Old Testament and a promise of God. If you offer the first fruits. And?
The best, the first.
Okay.
Preeminent.
All right. So when you offer God the first fruits of your harvest as a gift, a sacrifice to him, what would did he promise? There would be second and third and fourth, more harvest to come. You give to God first and he'll bless you with a good harvest. And so this idea is carried through with Jesus that he's been raised from the dead as the what? The first fruit. God, he offered himself to God, and he's the first fruit of those who are asleep. For since by one man came death, who's that a picture of? Adam, who started death to all men because sin spread, or death spread to all men because all of sin. By a man also came resurrection of the dead. Who's that? Jesus. For in Adam all die, but in Christ, all are going to be made alive. Who's the all there? All who believe and follow him, right? We're going to be made alive, each in his own order. Christ the first fruit, he's the first one. After that, those who are Christ at his coming. And then the end of the world. So this is a beautiful picture, and it's all because of the resurrection, and it's all has to do with this grain. Most of us here, well, let me say that, all of us here, unless the Lord comes quickly, are going to be buried in the ground, right? Some sooner than others. And is that okay? We're just like a seed, our body planted in the ground. Our spirit returns to God. But the promise is someday, just as Christ rose from the dead, there is your promise. The fact that he did, you're going to raise from the dead too. When will that happen? When Jesus comes. You say, well, what kind of body? That's chapter 15. It's a spiritual body. It's sown in the ground, physical. It's raised spiritual. Is there anything about that plant that looks like the seed? The seed that goes in is totally different than the plant that comes out. Now, what's amazing, the plant produces more seed, and that's what Christ is doing. He's producing more seed, you and me. So we're going to have a spiritual body just like Christ. Now, that's all in that verse right there. Okay? Any questions about that? That's why we say the day of your death is the greatest day in your life. The greatest. Not the one you were born, because that's when you get to go be with your Father spiritually, and now you're going to partake in the promise of the resurrection. Yes?
Well, I'm confused. I thought when you died, your soul went to heaven.
Yes?
It does,
but your body goes in the ground. We're talking about the body. It's planted in the ground.
Right?
And it's like a seed. And then when Christ comes, it said in 1 Thessalonians 4, he'll bring with him those who have fallen asleep in Christ. That's the spirits, your spirit. But your body's still in the ground, isn't it? It'll be raised and you'll be united with your spirit that time. All right? Did that? All right, good. All right, so, and now we know that from further study. Jesus doesn't announce it all here. But here he's going to talk about what it takes to be part of that first fruit. He who loves his life, what? Lose it. What? The Bible's full of these paradoxes, these contradictions. But if you hate your life in this world, you'll keep it to life eternal. So what does it mean to love your life in this world? Well, what is he referring to? Stuff about the world. I'm sorry? Self. It's about, yeah, about pleasing me and what I want. Remember the parable of the sower? The first was the hard path, never believed at all. The rocky soil, what happened to it? Because of persecutions. But the most problematic to me is the thorny soil. They still have a faith, but what did it say? The cares, the deceitfulness of riches, the cares of this world, the deceitfulness of riches and worries, it choked the word. So it never bore fruit. That's loving your life. Man, I got to get everything I have while I'm here for just a short while. I got to grab, 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 and it chokes. And he said, if you love your life, you're going to lose it in the end. Do we see that a lot? A lot of people, well, yeah, I'll follow Christ later. I'll follow Christ when I'm done with my career. I'll follow Christ. Sadly, most of those people, not always, but as a general rule, they never end up following Christ because they get so sucked up in the world, they never turn back to him. Now, there are exceptions to that, but the general rule, well, Jesus said it. If you love it, you're going to what? Lose it. But if you hate it, now what does that mean? Hate, I hate my life. I hate me. I hate who I am. No, hate your life. In other words, you love it less. That's what it means. Like hating your father or mother, he says you have to do that. In other words, love it less. You know, in other words, my life on this earth is unimportant. If you give me blessings, fine. I'll do the best I can, but I'm more interested in life eternal. In verse 26, if anyone serves me, now that's interesting, to be a follower of Christ, you're called to be a servant, to serve, right? And if you want to be served, you got to do what? You have to follow. Now, if you follow, what does that mean? Wherever Jesus ends up, that's where you're going to be also. Wherever I am. You know what it says? That's where you're going to find my servants as well. Then finally, he says, if you serve me, because that's where I am, you're serving me, you're also going to be serving who? The Father. We'll see this repeated over and over, this idea. Whatever is done for Jesus is done for the Father, because they're one and the same. So, a lot of times, I've thought, oh, I'm glad I don't have to die on the cross. I mean, aren't you? After go, but interesting, what does it say? Wherever, if you want to love me and serve me, you got to what? Follow me. And wherever I end up, where are you going to be? Right there with me. So wherever Jesus encountered, if you're going to be a disciple of Christ, you're going to encounter the same thing. And so when we talk about the cross, it's interesting. We're going to have to pick up our cross as well. Isn't that what he says? If you want to be a disciple of mine, you got to deny yourself, follow me, and pick up your cross what? Daily. Now, for some of these Christians that he's speaking to, will they have to give their life physically on a cross? Yeah, some are going to be martyrs for Christ. And if you love your life more than you love Christ, you're going to end up losing it. But if you choose to lose your life freely for Christ, he says you're going to keep it for eternity. You see that paradox? Same thing, the first will be last, the last should be first. So God's going to ask you to do tough things sometimes. Is that okay? Yes, but Lord, give me strength. Let it come slowly enough so I can endure. But wherever you go and wherever you lead me, I'm going to follow. No matter how tough it is. Okay? Yes?
He's basically asking us to emulate what
Exactly.
Everyone had a right to love his, I guess you call it life. He was at the right hand of God.
Yes.
And then lowered himself to become a servant and to die for us.
Yes. You know, and it's easy to avoid conflict. I don't like conflict. And but did Jesus, I don't want to say he looked for it with pleasure, but did he embrace conflict? Yes. Because sometimes when you're, well, it's just the way it is. When you're light and you're in the world of darkness, is there going to be conflict? You can't avoid it. And so if we're going to be following Christ, there's going to be conflict in your life as you engage in this world. Now, we have to be of the character, I'm going to engage and I'm going to endure because I don't care about the approval of the world. I more care about the approval of God. Now, it's interesting. When we look at this literally at the cross, how many disciples were there with him? How many were there with him? Zero. They all turned and fled. Peter followed from afar, but when it came down to crunch time, what did he do? Denied him three times. There was a disciple that followed him for a while until they tried to capture him. He fled away naked. That's in the book of Mark. I think it was probably Mark, all right? So they stood at a distance, but were they there serving Christ at his most needed moment? No. And sadly, we've all can say that maybe we've been there and not been there for Christ at some important moments in our life. But we learn from those, right? Did Peter learn from that? And we're just going to pick up and never look back and just keep looking forward. So very powerful. Wherever Christ is, that's where you're going to end up too. You're going to follow his steps to wherever he leads you. The word service, diakonos, is the same word for deacon. All right? McLaren writes this when it comes to the idea of follow me. Think of a man standing up before all mankind and coolly and deliberately saying to them, I am the realized ideal of human conduct. Isn't that true of Jesus? When you want the idea of how to live your life on this earth, isn't Jesus the epitome of that? He's the ideal. I am in the incarnate perfection. And all of you in all the infinite variety of condition, culture, and character. In other words, don't care where you come from, what ethnic background, what social class. You're to take me for your pattern and your guide. Is that not true? All people from all nations are called to follow Jesus and emulate him in everything. He's the perfect example or mentor. And so I think that's quite an interesting statement. So, any questions about that section? Because now in verse 27, he's going to talk about his death more specifically. So, the word troubled here, I got to get that with my glasses out. We see Jesus is being very intimate here when he's talking about his personal state of mind. Well, verse 27, my soul has become troubled. And what shall I say? Father, save me from this hour. Did he ask that actually? In the garden, not too long from now. He asked three times, let this cup pass. But this hour refers to his death, burial, and resurrection. He said, is that what I'm supposed to ask for? You know, he says, but for this purpose, I came to this hour. That's why I'm on this earth. And I guess the biggest thing following Christ to stick to it is you have to decide why you're here on this earth. And if you come up with that answer, why, you'll stay faithful to Christ. But if you don't have a strong enough why, you'll wander and fall away. Does that make sense? 4 years of college can be tough. And a lot of people drop out. I was one of them. All right? What's the key to staying in college and getting your degree? It's to know your purpose, why you're going there, right? And if your why is strong enough, you'll endure anything to get it. And so the same thing is here. Jesus said, should I ask God to let this cup pass? No, because he knows why he's here. And this is the very purpose and the way he can glorify God. So what amazing thing happened, he said, verse 28, Father, glorify thy name. And then there came a voice out of heaven. I would love to have heard it. Because when God speaks, we're in John 12, 28. You just wonder, it's audible for a week. It's a human language, the way he's speaking, right? You would love to. Is it deep? Is it loud? Is it thunderous? I don't know. But they all heard it and said, I have both glorified it and will glorify it again. And what is the it that he's going to glorify? His name. The multitude, therefore, who stood by and heard it were saying that it thundered. That's interesting. Some people didn't get it and didn't grasp it. And others were saying, no, an angel has spoken to him. So maybe they heard the voice but didn't understand what was being said. Now that happened in Acts chapter 9 when they saw Paul saw Jesus. He heard Jesus speak to him. It says in the text, they heard a voice but didn't understand what was said. So that's possible. All right. Yes. Exactly. Well, okay, so this is the third audible time God speaks from heaven to bear witness that Jesus is the Christ. What was the first time?
Baptist.
The baptism. When he was baptizing by John, God spoke, this is my beloved Son in whom I will please. All right, you got that one. What was the second time God spoke from heaven as a testimony? That transfiguration. He goes up on the mountain and they wake up from their sleep. Peter sees who? Moses, Elijah, and Jesus. And a cloud comes over, and God said, this is my beloved Son. Hear ye him. Listen to him. And when the cloud disappears, who's the only one left? Is it the giver of the law? No, Moses is gone. Is it the prophet? No, Elijah's gone. Who's the only one standing there? Jesus. So here's God picking out to his people, this is his Son. An amazing thing. Now, it's interesting, when Christ comes again, what will introduce him? Trumpets sound, the voice of the archangel. Won't you know Christ is coming? Because God's announcing it just like here, and it's going to be a thunderous voice, and you're going to go, oh, yes, or you're going to go, oh, no. Right? It's one or the other. It's a binary choice. It's either, oh, no, I'm in trouble, or, oh, yes. Really? There's no in-between, is there? And that's what he's talking about. So the word trouble, though, is to put in motion, tarasso. It means to shake back and forth. And figuratively, it means to agitate, inner perplexity, emotional agitation from getting stirred up or being upset. Now, I love this. Because Jesus is being vulnerable here. He's revealing to us his inner emotions, his humanity. What's he troubled about? Why is he upset, torn two ways? Does he want to die and suffer physical humiliation on the cross? No. Especially at the hands of his people that he created and knowing that he's going to have to battle Satan next after that. But the other hand, he wants to glorify God's name. So he wants to serve God, but his humanity says, cries out, no. But his soul, his spirit says, yes. So he's torn. He's troubled. Does that speak to all of us? We have those moments we're troubled. We're torn. But Jesus mentored for us. You just have to set aside, deny yourself, and just follow him. Yes.
And that should be comforting to us.
It is.
Because it shows us
yes.
Sometimes we think of him as a superhuman, and just like the three times that he prayed for this cup to pass in the garden, there was a human side of him.
Yeah.
I don't want to do this.
Yes. You know, we've talked about it. I've been at fault in my own mind thinking that Jesus couldn't sin because he was God in the flesh. Well, no. He was God in the flesh, tempted in all things like you and I. And now, if he was tempted, that means he could sin just like you and I. And this is another clue into his soul. He's troubled right here. This is tough for him. And that's why he's going to spend the next three chapters in 13, 14, 15, actually in 16 with his disciples, his closest friends. Because this is the trying moment in his life. So there is that section. Look at verse 29. We read that. Now we're going to look at his comments about his death and about how he's going to deal with Satan. Verse 31. Now judgment is upon this world, and now the ruler of this world shall be cast out. And if I be lifted up from the earth, I will draw all men to myself. But he was saying this to indicate what kind of death by which he was to die. Now we understand the multitude got this to a degree, because they're thinking he's the Christ, and they must understand that he's saying he's going to be lifted up to die, because they answered and said, verse 34, we've heard out of law the Christ is to remain forever. And how can you say the Son of Man must be lifted up? Who is the Son of Man? See their confusion? They knew the Old Testament, that it said Daniel chapter 2, Isaiah chapter 2, Isaiah 9, that his kingdom would last forever. He would reign on the throne of David forever. It'd be an everlasting throne. So they understood the Old Testament scripture, that when the Christ came, he would live for or reign forever. So they're thinking reign forever means what? Live forever. Because they're still thinking what? A physical kingdom, not a spiritual. That's the source of their confusion. So Jesus said, therefore, in verse 35 to them, for a little while longer the light is among you. Walk while you have the light, so the darkness may not overtake you. He who walks in the darkness does not know where he goes. While you have the light, believe in the light in order that you might become sons of light. So these things he spoke, and he departed and hid himself from them. So let's take a look at this section. First of all, he says the ruler of this world. Obviously, that's who? Satan. He's called the God of this world in the Corinthian letter. He works in the spirit of disobedience, Ephesians chapter 2. Is he literally a God? No. But has he been given control up to this time over the world as far as tempting and deceiving and accusing the brethren? Yes. Here he says, I've come, I'm going to cast him out. Now, it's interesting. This actually happens when he enters the grave, because we see in Hebrews chapter 2, Jesus had to partake of flesh and blood so he might render powerless him who had the power of death. And who is that? Satan. He calls him there, Satan. So he can deliver us who had from the one that had control over us. That would be Satan. Well, that happens in the grave. And we see in Matthew chapter 12, when he's casting out demons, what did the Pharisees say? You're doing it by Satan. And he goes, that's stupid. Why would Satan cast out his own enemy? I mean, his own helpers, right? Because the kingdom divided falls. He says, but if you want to loot a man's house, what do you got to do? Bind the strong man, tie him up, then you can loot him. So what's Jesus going to do right here on the cross? He's going to bind Satan so he can rob him of all those people that he's been accusing night and day. The sinners, righteous people, I mean, faithful people, but sinners. Who would that include? Abraham, Rahab, you know, Esther, David, all those people in the Old Testament that have died up to this point. So that's what he says. Now, if I'm lifted up from the earth, what's that a picture of? The cross. I'm going to draw who? This is what Lorraine said earlier when he said the hour's come. Who? Not just Jews, everyone. What is the single thing that draws us to Christ? What should it be? The cross. Salvation. The cross. Because when you look at the cross, you ask a couple things. Why? If that's God, his son, why? And if the answer is what? He loves us that much, he wants to save us. And I want to follow a man or a God like that loves me that much that he would come down and die for me. Isn't that what draws us to Christ? It's not fear. It's the picture of love. Yes, Roy.
Why the word if in 32?
Why the word if? In the Greek, and we do the same thing, there's a first class, second class, and third class conditional sentence. Now, a conditional sentence is like this. If you are Superman, then fly. Now, do I believe he's Superman? No. I'm challenging him, right? That's a first class. We don't believe the first thing is true, so you're challenging. A second class, and a third class especially, assume something to be true, and the word if means since. Since you're Superman, you know, show me some x-ray vision power, okay? I want to see some excitement, right? The second one is it's assumed to be true, and that's what he's saying. But the people don't believe it yet, do they? They don't understand that he's going to be lifted up on the cross. So he says, if, meaning when, or since I'm going to be lifted on the cross, see what I'm saying? We do that too, right? If it's dinner time, let's go, right? And pretty soon, someone's going to be raising their hand in the back going, cut it. And I go, oh, if it's quarter after, I guess I'm done. Now, am I doubting that it's quarter after? No, I'm saying since. All right, someone had their hand up. Matt?
The word can also be translated as when or though. Mm-hmm.
If, yeah. But we use that language a lot, so it's a good question. All right, so basically is when or since I'm going to be lifted up, I'm going to draw all men to myself. And that's true, right? So that's a kind of death. Now, the rule of this world, those are all the scriptures. We referred to them. It's interesting. He came to judge. We're going to see in a little bit, if we get there, he said, I didn't come to judge. But here he says, I'm coming to judge, right? Judgment is upon this world. And specifically, I think he's pointing to the rule of this world, all right? And that was his job, okay? Because to seek and save the lost, he has to judge the ones that have kept or people lost, all right? So let's look at the next verse. We already read it. The crowd asked him, well, we're confused because the scripture said you're going to be, the Christ is going to live forever. We can find that in Isaiah 9 and 7, some of the scripture down there. And that's, his answer is really not an answer, is it? Now, why would I say that? What was the question? You're saying you're going to die. The scripture says the Christ lives forever. Can you explain that? Does he explain it? No. He just says, well, I'm just going to be a little while, the light is among you. He's the light. So walk while you have the light, so darkness won't overtake you. Believe in the light, so you can become sons of light. Then he went and hid himself. Did he explain it? No, he didn't, did he? But he's appealed to him, if you believe that I am the Christ, here's all I ask you, is just follow me. Follow me. Walk by faith and not by sight. All right? So that leads us to the last section here, and I think it's the most powerful here, why some people don't believe. And we're just about out of time, so we'll get through this section where he quotes Isaiah, and then we'll save the last few verses till next week, Lord willing. Here's a summary statement, and because he's left the temple area, and we find in the other Gospels he would leave and come back every day during the Passover week. But here's a summary statement of chapters 1 through 12, because remember, the rest of the chapter, the book of John, is going to deal with this last week in his life. So here's a summary. He had performed many signs. Remember chapter 21 says, there are many signs which are not, he said, if all the signs hadn't been recorded, there wouldn't be enough books in the world. All right, it's a figure of speech, but here it said so many signs. We have 7 recorded for him, but there must have been hundreds of them if we're talking that kind of language. And yet, they're not believing him. And the big question is, why? Why? If you saw someone walk in water, would that not be good enough? And if that's not good enough, you saw him heal a blind man that you were personally aware of from birth for 40 years, would that be enough? You know, you'd think an honest, open-minded person, it would just take a few, if not just one. But here's many, and yet they're not believing. Now, we are led to believe sometimes to think the signs are not good enough then. That's the conclusion. Signs do not produce evidence. And they're not sufficient. We need more. Have you ever felt that? That's not the issue. The issue is not that the miracles are not sufficient enough to give you faith in Jesus Christ, that he's the Son of God. That's not the problem. The problem's not with the miracle. The problem's with the person. Now, that's what we have to talk about. Yes? Sure.
But at the same time, many. And if you have this bombardment of these things taking place, of these fortune tellers and signs and then these are whatever. I think there's some doubt on the part of a lot of people.
That could be part of it. But even, remember in Acts 8 when Philip was doing real miracles, who did he convert to Christ? Simon the sorcerer.
Because he saw the difference between what was going on.
He knew fake ones and real ones.
But the point is...
And so did the people, though, is what I'm saying.
Yes, he made a living at this, and he was able to deceive many.
Well, my point is to counter what you're saying, because I agree what you're saying, that when you see a real miracle, then you know these were fakes.
Right.
His are so far above what they were doing. But you can get desensitized to it.
It's like in the world we live today, Jack. You think about it. All this different stuff going on with religion out there and the deception that is...
I know, but has anyone performed a legitimate miracle today?
No.
I mean, raise someone from the dead like Jesus did Lazarus.
No.
If you did, would everyone all of a sudden believe? The answer is what? No, because the problem's not with the miracle. The problem's with the heart. You're up, and then I'm out of time because they're going...
The exact conversation with Nicodemus. Nicodemus, John 3, says, to quote, Rabbi, we know that you are a teacher from God because no one can do these signs unless
exactly.
God is with him.
Yeah.
They knew he was from God.
All right, so we'll look next week at why they're not believing. So come back for that, and we'll finish. Thank you.